You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today is the 15th of January, 2020. Again, I'd like to appeal to my listeners and readers to donate to my existence. Many of you know the position I've been in for some time, the struggles that a full-time guy without any institutional support will have. For those who have been generous, you know how much I thank you, and I know who you are. It's been extremely difficult for me to get personalized thank yous out, and I apologize for that. I also have my Patreon page, where I have essays where you can't get them anywhere else. If you go to my site, there's a box for it right there. You can't miss it. And on that particular little project, I publish a lot of things that I'm not normally known for. You know, analyses of works of art, current events, even pop culture. You know, not just, you know, Russian Orthodox and related issues. I do have a few of them, but this is a place where I can get a bit more, stretch myself a bit more. And also consider that as well. It's actually quite successful Patreon is a great service. So, we ended last week. We began last week talking about Iran. As you know, little has changed except that the U.S. seems to be backing down. Last Thursday I discussed with Sven how the U.S. simply doesn't have the capacity for any real concerted action. The main forward base is in a pro-Iran country, and so they're dependent on the Diego Garcia base, which is, I think, something like 2,500 miles away. How stable the House of Saud is anyone's guess. But the, when I first got into this field 30 years ago, Saudi Arabia was still very anti-Israel and was financing the Intifada in the West Bank. The actual event that turned me against the Israeli government, I had a kind of a benevolent neutrality up until that point, was when the Saudis approached, at the time the prime minister was Shamir, the Likud party, and offered them a deal. If you withdraw from the West Bank and Gaza Strip, Saudi Arabia will mobilize the Arab world to lift the embargo, declare a state of peace, and have a situation like you had with Egypt after 1979. Free trade and everything else. Even assistance, if necessary, from the Saudi monarchy. And Shamir said no. And that struck me. That struck me as that was front page of New York Times, I want to say maybe 91, maybe early 92, that happened. And it struck me. My first thought was that Israel needs war. This is what happens when you really don't belong somewhere. You have this very strong patron, at least financially, willing to support you. You have to constantly justify that money. You need a constant state of war. You need to be threatened all the time. What would peace mean? They'll start killing each other, as they were doing recently in Jerusalem, where the Hasidics and the secular Jews are despising each other. They do in Turakart and all these other groups and elsewhere. So that's, you know, that really is what turned me away from it. Now, things have changed. That was 30 years ago. Saudi Arabia now is essentially a Zionist regime. They can't be too loud about that, but in their support of the U.S., they realize that to get that, you know, again, they're frightened to death of radical states like Iran and Syria, so they have to get closer and closer to really the only person who's willing to support them, and that's the United States. So I don't think the monarchy there is too stable. I'm a royalist, as everyone knows. My very first political declaration many years ago was that I was a monarchist. But I'm not sure the House of Saud is legitimate since it was the creation of the British government. Anyway, we ended last week on the myths of the Russo-Japanese War. And the last thing I discussed was when General Nogi, the commander of the infantry at Port Arthur, killed himself. There's one myth that I have to dispel. It's been in every single generalized history textbook on Russian history, pre-revolutionary history I've ever come across. The claim that in 1904, the Minister of the Interior at the time, Vyacheslav Pliv, stated, in order to keep the revolution at bay, we need a small victorious war. In other words, that the Tsarist government deliberately provoked a war in Japan because they thought it would be quick and easy and would rally the people around them. Now, the phrase was taken really from U.S. Secretary of State John Hay. He is the source of this story. He said that about Russia. Pliev never said this. The Russian government did everything it could to avoid war with Japan. It was willing to make concessions in Korea, the Japanese. The army and the navy, that far away, were not ready for war. Now, the Japanese attack was at night, before any declaration of war, unexpected. They were successful at sea, but not on land. And in fact, in Petersburg, people didn't even believe it. The number of troops in Manchuria had been reduced. The point of that was to not provoke a war. So, of course, the story is a myth. The Trans-Siberian Railway had yet to be completed. It's insane for a guy like Pliev to say anything like that. There was no way that he would ever make that claim. Unfortunately, what happened was that the revolution, revolutionary movement almost succeeded in 1905, 1906, using the Russo-Japanese War as their foundation. They desperately needed this war, not the Russian government. They needed it. The British and the U.S. encouraged this war. Loans were issued. Military supplies were sent. Ships, all kinds of upgrades at great cost. Nicholas II personally was against this war, as he was against World War I. On March 26, 1903, Grand Duke Alexei Alexandrovich, Witte, Pliev, Lambsdorff, Kropotkin, general who we mentioned last time, and General Alexei Kropotkin writes that, concerning Nicholas, he says that one should avoid an argument or a quarrel with Japan, and that war with her is completely and utterly undesirable at this point. Now, Nicholas II was not Supreme Commander-in-Chief of the armed forces in that particular area. That's not how the Russian system works. It was simply too far away. Local commanders may have made errors, but there is no way Nicholas II could have been issuing orders that took quite a long time to get there. In 1905, the height of the war, January of 1905, the revolution began. We talked about why the press screamed that they lost the war, and why would Nicholas go to the negotiating table if they were winning, you know, or at least fighting up to a draw, which is really what it was. But the strikes of 1905, were substantial. The strikes in Petersburg and other industrial cities were based on newspaper reports, which I've read, that have local corruption and treasonous activities as the foundation for the loss of the war that was still going on at the time with the Japanese. In other words, the Japanese were presented as these weak, poor souls, and the Russians couldn't beat them because traitors had taken over the government either in Petersburg or over there. There was no press censorship in Russia at the time, except in the most extreme cases. Newspapers were closed down, but no differently than in America today. So because of that, strikes broke out. Supplies couldn't leave the stations. The railroad workers had a tendency to be the most radical of them all, and they, in certain places, simply refused to work. So this is an extremely important notion, and the so-called constitution was issued. The reforms of 1905 came into existence because of lies about this war. And one of the reasons that Nicholas had to go to the negotiating table is he had to take care of this domestic problem at home. They were taking advantage of this and really forcing his hand. The Japanese, I think, realized this at one point, but not until later. I think I said last time that the Japanese government almost fell. There were demonstrations. There was substantial public mourning over the loss of the Russo-Japanese War. Just like in the Crimean War we dealt with not too long ago, when Russia is portrayed as losing, and wars are so vivid as far as political legitimacy, the state legitimacy is concerned. A victorious war is an affirmation of the system. A lost war is a humiliation. And what the left did in the Russian media at the time was take even the slightest defeat, or they'd have to just invent one out of whole cloth, and the line would be exactly the same. And American historians do that every single day. They'll say, well, it was the Tsarist government, therefore it was backwards and it was feudal. Remnants of serfdom still existed. There were nothing like the British, and therefore, this is proof that they simply couldn't function in the modern world. So really, that's what this is all about. It's the same line over and over again, no matter who you're talking about. Like Geoffrey Hosking, the British, very famous British historian on Russian history, says the same things. Again, he makes the same claim. The Russians lost the war. They were humiliated. They were completely defeated, and the reason was that Russia was a third world state, so to speak. But we know that the Japanese, I think I said last time too, the Japanese were at 100% mobilization, not just in terms of infantry, fuel, but also money. They were absolutely exhausted. Russia really didn't notice the war too much, financially speaking, but the press made a huge deal about it. This was a major war. In fact, it might even be called the World War because it involved many states. But this wasn't, this is something that the Russians had to get out of for reasons I've already said. I mean, the revolutionary movement was making it impossible to function. It's also stated, I believe the Russian press, I can't remember off the top of my head if I've read this or not, but it was a long time ago. But there was a claim in the Russian press that Russia surrendered unconditionally. So not just the war was humiliating, but the peace was humiliating. It's believed that Russia, having signed the peace at Portsmouth in New Hampshire, which is where they had negotiations, this gave to Japan everything they wanted, and Japan became an absolute winner. But, of course, it's not the case. Russia simply couldn't continue the war because of internal unrest. It offered peace to Japan on this basis. Of course, you can't say that, but that was pretty much it. The war would be continued, though, if the Japanese pushed too hard. Nicholas said that he sincerely wants the negotiations to come to a peaceful solution, but only I cannot allow one penny of indemnity nor the cession of one inch of land, he stated. Now, what did Japan want? Now, Russia agreed to end its influence in Korea and Manchuria. Russia was to withdraw troops from Manchuria. At the request of Russia, though, Japan also had to withdraw troops. Russia refused to give up the island of Sakhalin and everything adjacent to it. They will not pay military expenses. They will not transfer the remaining fleet to Japan. They will not limit its fleet to the Far East. I believe that they did pay for the cost of housing Russian POWs, but I think that was mutual. Russia agreed to transfer the railway between Harbin and Port Arthur to Japan, as well as the rental rights of Port Arthur, Tellian, and surrounding areas. The Trans-Manchurian Railway couldn't be used for anything military. But again, that's both sides. But Japan agreed to many of Russia's demands. So, the peace treaty sounds like this. Russia ceases to have any influence in Korea. Now, I'm not entirely sure what influence means. But this was a very, you know, very distant place from Russian concerns. Russia leaves Manchuria, but Japan takes its troops out of there too. Renting the facilities of places like Tellian and Port Arthur is transferred to Japan. Railway transfer. The southern islands in the Sakhalin archipelago are transferred, but not the main ones. The Trans-Manchurian Railway is used only for commercial and industrial purposes. The Japanese could fish along the shores of Russian possessions. And of course, reimbursing housing of POWs. What they refused to do was reimburse all the war expenses, transfer its fleet, and limit its military presence in the water in the Far East. So Russia was negotiating from a position of strength, not weakness. It was very clear that Japan was straining, that they were struggling. When the treaty, you see this in my third Rome, my very first book, when the treaty was signed, the Japanese ambassador said, "Thank God," this is a paraphrase, of course, "thank God we couldn't last any longer. We are completely exhausted." When the treaty was signed, though, this is a Russian writer, Oldenburg, a royalist who I haven't dealt with yet. Writing in a Russian newspaper, and he says this when the treaty was signed about Japan. "Not such a war was awaited by the Japanese masses, lighted with news of victories. When the terms of the treaty were published, violent unrest erupted in Japan. Cities were covered with mourning flags. Barricades were erected on the streets, burning the building of the official newspaper, Khartoum. When it came to the ratification in Parliament, the protests fell silent. The fact is really characteristic," the Japanese commander-in-chief Oyama said, defending the treaty, "that after a whole year, victoriously ending for us with Mukden, the Japanese army, in 5.5 months, does not dare go on the offensive." That means the war at least was a draw, and the only reason it's a draw is that domestic concerns force Russia's hand. Peace was done on honorable terms in an area that's very marginal to Russian interests. They didn't get what they wanted. Because of this defeat, Japanese engaged in substantial military reforms from 1905 to 1912, which really altered how they made war. And it, you know, of course, the U.S. is going to face that very soon. So now that's the part two section of this. I said I wasn't going to do the whole thing. Wasn't going to be that. But that's, I had to finish up the rest of it there, the treaty and everything else. So what's very obnoxious about both Crimea and Russo Japan is that the media decides policy. The media created reality. Because no one could actually just run over to Port Arthur and see what's going on, the press could say whatever the heck they want. things were invented, are still being invented. All kinds of mocking of the emperor and everything was going on. Russia's defeated, Russian soldiers slaughtered, treasonous generals, Nicholas II's in on it. Terrible things. And so the corruption's everywhere. And this is what led to the strikes, the railway workers and others, and led to the reforms of 1905, 1906 in Russia, freedom of religion and stuff like that. And of course, the establishment of the Duma, which was a complete disaster, as much for the, as for the left as anybody else, because it did absolutely nothing. It did what parliaments do. And that is fight one another and blame one another for everything. Now, this isn't actually probably worth a show to talk about that, the four parliaments that Russia had. I talk about it briefly in the Third Rome, but that only exists because of the press. Same thing for Crimea. That means in the Anglo-American world, because the British press, needless to say, wasn't exactly objective, we have an absolutely twisted idea of what the war was like in the West. Now, about the 20-minute mark here, I want to talk about something that's probably not worth an entire show, but it's something that I recently discovered. And I had to go over the issue like 40 times before I could believe it. The 2018 Olympic Games in Korea reopened an issue that most people had forgotten about. And that was the terrorist downing of Korean Air Flight 858, the 29th of November, 1987. There, the plane is coming from the Middle East, blew up in midair from a bomb that was put inside the overhead storage bin, allegedly by two North Korean agents. They planted a device before leaving the aircraft. They were at a stopover in the United Arab Emirates. But as it got close to Bangkok, Thailand, it detonated and killed everybody, which was 104 passengers and 11 crew members, and almost everyone was of South Korean background. The official story, both in South Korea and the United States, and I've read the congressional hearings on this, there isn't a single sentence that makes any sense. Nothing. The woman, you may have heard of her. The woman who was responsible, North Korean terrorist Kim Won-hwa, who allegedly confessed to this crime. I've read her book recently, downloaded it for free. I can't, you know, I'm gonna use the phrase "what" a lot, so I can make no sense out of this. And because of the Olympics in 2018, this issue has been reopened in Korea, and this woman is now in trouble. She's a phony. She did not do this. That's the punchline here. Here's what she claimed. I just finished reading her biography. Tears of My Soul. And I'm convinced that soul is, it was written in English, by the way. Soul, is a play on words. I'm sorry, I'm wrong. It was immediately translated into English. It was an American publishing company. All right, sorry. Doesn't matter because it's the same thing. Soul is a play on words. Here's her story. She was born to a very privileged North Korean family. She was extremely attractive, and everyone said so. She was very interested in theater and trained as an actress. That's really important. And was studying languages. At a very early age, roughly 14 or so, she, for no reason whatsoever, was chosen by the party to become a James Bond-type spy for the Korean Workers' Party. She never explains why this would be, She was an, you know, she was a good student. They all have to do military training, even women. She was very poor at that. She wasn't very strong. There was nothing special about her at all, except for her looks. Because, of course, we're useful in espionage. That's not what this is about. So for no reason, they decide to make her into the female Korean James Bond. And she goes through rigorous training that she tries to describe in the book, but what she describes is not even as good as what you see in the movies. I mean, clearly she wasn't trained by these people. They didn't even try to make it look good. It's actually a pretty stupid book, very poorly written. And it's not done very well at all. The reason I thought it was written initially in English because there's no translator here. The cover of the book has her in a ninja outfit. Just her head. It's very clear she has no idea what this kind of training would entail. And nothing, and she's still alive, nothing in her life since this point suggests that she's anything special in that regard whatsoever. Then, as a rookie, she is asked personally by Kim Jong-il, who was second in command because Kim Il-sung was still alive at the time, personally requested her to blow up this airliner. So, I mean, I laughed at this point. That's what they're going to give to a rookie. They were, the bomb was pretty ingenious. It wasn't detected or anything. It was liquid explosives in a transistor radio and a bottle of wine. And they were meant to be the catalyst for the other. And put it in the overhead compartment. They disembarked the plane, one of its many layovers in the UAE, and somehow were detained. It was noted that they had a fraudulent Japanese passport. Now I laughed at that. Now I think that may have been, like McLovin's Hawaii driver's license. You think that North Korea would be able to put together a fake ID that would work. But apparently they went to the same guy McLovin did, because that's essentially what it was. And that's why she was detained. They had cigarettes within the filters with the cyanide capsules. Her partner took his. Guess who didn't take hers? She either pretended to, or took a small part, or threw it up, or whatever it is, made sure a guard was there when she did it. This guy dies, she's fine. She's now number one suspect because the plane at this point had blown up over Thailand. They use the Japanese name of a North Korean agent, which is strange because if you have a Japanese, there's a Japanese group that's very pro-North Korea, used to be a terrorist group, used to be active. The last thing you would use as a pseudonym is a name of one of their people. So right away, you have another red flag here, no pun intended. She's eventually extradited to Korea. Now note that riots were engulfing Korea. This is 1987. This is the one time the police lost control of the riot situation, which led to the creation of the combat police and all this stuff. The military government of Chun Doo-hwan had fallen, and elections were promised. This was an election year. And the so-called conservative candidate was a former general, Roh Tae-woo, who won it and was president of South Korea when I first got into this field in the early 90s. The South Korean government is extremely upset. She needs to be brought back before Election Day. And this, of course, is what North Korea eventually said. We didn't do it. But the only person that benefited was the government in South Korea. I've been very supportive of the government of South Korea until this point. But the military government at this point was gone. Chung Hee Park was the master, and his successors were not up to the challenge. She shows up in South Korea one day before the presidential election, which, of course, the conservatives win. In fact, they sweep it. All of a sudden, the riots stop because everything is focused on this act of terror. 100 Koreans have been killed. North Korea was blamed. North Korea denied all responsibility. No other group took responsibility. Now, this is the strange thing. Usually, when any act like that, any event like that occurs, every terrorist group on planet Earth takes responsibility for it. That's the whole point of terrorism. They have to know you did it. You know, if you want to hurt someone so they leave you alone, you have to make sure that they know it's you that's hurting them, or else it's worthless. Like after 9/11, every terrorist group on Earth claimed responsibility except Osama. If a terrorist group says we didn't do it, then they definitely didn't do it. Because what they would love is to be able to take responsibility for something they didn't do. I want to talk about sometime very soon the Arrow Air disaster in 1985, which was another USS Liberty. The plane crashed over Canada. I'll be talking about this very, very soon. No one's talking about this. I'm going to talk about this. But for now, I can't keep all the cover-ups straight here. North Korea's response is actually very sarcastic. Ultimately, the claim was that North Korea wanted to disrupt the Seoul Olympics by having people believe that it was unsafe. So they planted this bomb. This North Korean agent gets to Seoul and is interrogated. Now, her book, the stories vary. Her stories changed over the years. And initially, she's firm. I don't know what you're talking about. I have nothing to do with any of this. She spoke Japanese without an accent, Korean without an accent. There's a North and South distinction. The distinctions between North and South Korean really are slight. There's a lot of foreign loanwords in the South that don't exist in the North. The North tends to be more formal, with more powerful intonation. It's more aggressive in its linguistic. It strikes South Koreans as being older, formally, much more formal, older form of Korean. There's a slight accent distinction. But you have some people in the South who have it, and the North who have the Southern version. So it's not as severe as like someone from Boston, someone from Alabama. It is perfectly, they're not two separate languages by any means whatsoever. For reasons unknown, being driven through the city to an interrogation, she notices how wonderful people live in Seoul, South Korea. She claims that she was always told by the communists that capitalist countries are poverty stricken. There's race riots everywhere. There's poverty everywhere, homelessness everywhere. And the funny thing is, in 87, there were riots all over Seoul, South Korea at the time. So what she's saying is nonsensical. Plus the fact that the woman was trained, allegedly, by elite North Korean forces, had lived all over the world. Now, where did Kim Jong-un get his education? She knew all the European capitals. And it was that realization of how wonderful Seoul was and that car ride that broke through her brainwashing, and she confessed to the act. That's what did it. I don't have enough time to go through the list of all the absurdities here. One car ride through Seoul, South Korea, convinced her that all of the propaganda that she had been fed her whole life was false. First of all, that's not how brainwashing works. It's not that easily dislodged. Second of all, Seoul had been racked by riots up until that point. Third, the woman had been to every major European capital at that time. She was in the Secret Service. She was from an elite family. In fact, the very mission that she was on brought her to different capitals. So for her to claim later that seeing how beautiful Seoul was, all of a sudden I realized, oh my God, North Korea is wrong. And she threw herself at a female interrogator saying, I did it, please forgive me. And this gets much worse. Of course, she's tried and found guilty, and she's sentenced to death. What happens next, I'm going to say, is probably the most bizarre event of the Cold War, which is saying a lot. She was immediately pardoned by Roh Tae-woo. Remember, Roh Tae-woo was a general. He was part of the junta of Chun Doo-hwan. He is a vehement anti-communist. She is immediately, instantaneously pardoned from her crime. She is a free woman. So if anyone wants to pull off a mass murderer in North Korea, in South Korea, I know how to do it. It is the most bizarre, twisted tale that I've ever come across. Obviously, Roh Tae-woo knew that she didn't do it, that the confession was as phony as everything else. Now, what was his reasoning? His reasoning was as bad as her explanation. Depending on when you would ask him, he gave a few different reasons. The first one was that, well, she confessed. And that proved that she's remorseful, therefore she can go free. There's only so much you could say about that. Obviously, it's nonsense. Number two, and the main one, the one he stuck with, was that she was brainwashed, and therefore it's not her fault. Every terrorist is brainwashed. In fact, you could say gang members are. One has nothing to do with the other. I don't have to explain this to you. It's obviously absurd. And the third one, which came up once in a while, was, I think she should live so she could see and feel that guilt for the rest of her life and have it torture her. That's why President Roh Tae-woo pardoned this mass murderer and North Korean terrorist. So we have one of the worst things, one of the worst Cold War atrocities in the Korean world, which is saying something, occur. It was front page news at the time, very quickly forgotten. It is highly unlikely North Korea had anything to do with this. The fact that the congressional hearings are nothing but official. These are American officials giving official statements. That's all it was. So they really weren't hearings. The other side was not represented. And it was the Committee for Asian Affairs, Subcommittee for Asian Affairs. And their arguments were weak. Most of their evidence that this was a North Korean terrorist act came from the fact that she confessed that she was one. That she occasionally spoke with a North Korean accent using North Korean dialect. But of course, being a trained actress, that doesn't mean anything. Remember, she's at the time, a very attractive woman. This is one of the most extreme expressions of female privilege that I've ever come across. The very fact that she would, the newspaper said she recovered from her poison. Like this little woman, the North Koreans don't know what they're doing. When they give their cyanide ration to these people in cigarettes. North Korea realized that this was a disaster for them. Can you imagine being so ridiculous to think that blowing up an airliner, not saying anything, not saying it's you, in fact denying it, is going to destroy the Olympics in 1988? The opposite was true, as everyone would know. The cult of martyrdom is huge in Asian countries. It almost sanctified those Olympics. The North Koreans were well aware of this. And there are many sarcastic responses, one of which was, we're not morons, so we didn't do this. The only person that benefited was Roh Tae-woo and the South Korean elite. This was a way to stop the rioting. This was a way to get the economy back on track. This was a way to win the election, the first one in a long time. To pardon this woman was a way to say we know she didn't do it. It gets much worse. She, by the way, is a multimillionaire. No one has any idea where the money came from. She's living, I've heard she's fled the country recently, very recently, but I have not had that confirmed. She's still alive. She was just on NBC in 2018. She became a violently anti-North Korean activist, which was the act in the first place. That was her purpose. Her attitude is more pro-American than it is pro-South. She claimed in one of her discussions that she was involved with the North Korean abduction of Japanese teenagers. And this would be right around the time where she was allegedly an agent. In the 6 years between 1977 and 1983, 17 Japanese, at least those that were recognized by the state, were abducted by North Korea. There may have been more. And there's others, you know, non-Japanese too, the claim. It was mostly in the coastal areas. These are kind of average Japanese people, more like opportunistic than anything else. She claimed to have been a part of this. In fact, she claimed to train the agents who were to go in and do this, because blowing up a plane gives you the authority to do this. This actually would have been before the plane blew up. But again, she must have been still being in the academy most of the time. However you slice it, it's a stupid story. She would have been way too young to train anybody. For a long time, the U.S. said it didn't happen. This is a conspiracy theory. Of course, now it's true. As I've said in my lecture on Park Chung-hee, the U.S. tilted to North Korea for some time, which would explain the Pueblo and the attack and the eventual murder of Chung-hee Park. Initially, the U.S. denied this was going on. Even the Japanese did, but eventually it was fully admitted. She said out of nowhere one day that she wants to go over there and apologize to the children that she, who hadn't been returned, or at least the families, that she'd done this. The Japanese said, well, we have a problem because we won't allow anybody who's done prison time in another country to visit Japan. This is why Ozzy Osbourne can't play Japan. It's very strict. Somehow, they withdrew that objection. The law went out the window. And she goes over there and has some photo shoots. She's hugging people and everything else. It's absolutely ridiculous. The woman just admitted that she was a part of this kidnapping, and nothing's done to her. There was a threat to arrest her, not for that, not for blowing up the plane, but for having the fake passport in the first place in Abu Dhabi with the Japanese name of a North Korean agent. That's what they're going to arrest her for. That was her big problem. Not the fact that she had just admitted that she was a part of this, which at the time was a massive issue. This wasn't that long ago. It was a massive issue in Japan. Very emotional. So somehow the law goes out the window. She goes over there. She goes back. She's in a secret location because she's afraid North Korean agents are going to kill her. No, she's afraid South Koreans are going to kill her. There's an interview right after she was pardoned where she says, "Ask, you know, you're going to have a normal life. You're going to marry." And she said, "Marry? How can I marry? All this guilt on my shoulders." She was married in a short time, but she married one of the intelligence agents that was assigned to protect her. Now, what struck me there is that these agents are under strict orders to never fraternize with their charges. Absolutely, you know, the very fact that they would marry would mean this guy would get fired right away. There is no personal relationship there. This generally says to me that she was a South Korean intelligence from the beginning. She's known this guy for a long time. It's not possible that you marry one of your bodyguards at state expense. And where's this woman's money coming from? So to sum up, 1987, Korean airliner is blown up in Southeast Asia. North Korea is blamed. They arrest two people on phony passport charges. One of whom kills himself, the other one does not. She's a female. She's brought to South Korea. She's sentenced to death and is immediately pardoned. And now lives a life of luxury in South Korea with permanent state-funded bodyguards. That's where we are, believe it or not. I have to keep repeating it because I can't believe it. It gets a lot worse. By the way, many of you know the Black Book of Communism. There's a short piece in there, Communism and Terrorism. The last paragraph is about her. And the author is convinced that her book is mostly fiction. That's why he doesn't talk about it very much. He said at the time he wasn't 100% sure. It's being analyzed right now. But I think most people in South Korea and people who know the situation know that it's phony. I mentioned her case had been reopened. There is a lawyers group in South Korea that's dedicated to, it's actually sort of the family of the victims group. And their lawyers have demanded the state reopen her case. They've uncovered a tremendous amount of evidence from Soviet files, American files, South Korean files, declassified over the many years since this occurred. There was no investigation into this woman. There was no attempt to find the truth. They want this reopened and to find, and they believe that South Korea was behind it. South Korea blew up their own plane. I don't know for certain. That's a stretch for me. But given that the fact that the country was in convulsions, those convulsions created by the West, were created by the United States. South Korea was an extremely prosperous country at the time. These convulsions were created by the West, but they existed. It may have been an act of desperation. I think the U.S. had more to do with it. And part of me is because her post-pardon talks have supported the American line, not the South Korean line, on North Korea. They've said a lot of the things that I've just said. And they're the first ones, to, believe it or not, the first ones to do this. Now, if it's in Korean, I don't know. I don't speak it or read it. But this group says she didn't do it. She's full of it. She's an actress. She's pulled the wool over your eyes. Her book makes no sense. Nothing about her life is true. Apparently, her father was sent to a labor camp. Well, there's no generals at that period of time that were sent anywhere, as far as anyone knows, in South Korea. And they would know. You know, a major figure like that being purged, they would know. There's no such, there's nothing. There's no connection. Her connection to North Korea may not even be. I don't know. The accent's not that tough for a professional actress to learn. She was already studying languages wherever she was. She could be North Korean. She could be a double agent. I don't know. These things are complicated. She speaks many languages. When she went on NBC, she spoke only in Korean. That might be an act. I think she knows English. They also note, this is back in 2007 when this first occurred, there is a continuing saga, that the cyanide capsules, from what they have, the remnants of it and from the cigarette pack, are not of North Korean make. Whoever did this made it look like it's a North Korean hit. They usually have groups of three. Their agents kill themselves with a cyanide capsule hidden somewhere. That's easy enough to fake. Obviously, the woman wasn't brainwashed if she didn't kill herself. That's the worst part of all this, that anyone could actually buy that. There's a State Intelligence Truth and Reconciliation Commission. There's a lot of liberals on that, a lot of non-Koreans on that. It's mostly an American thing. But they also want this case reopened. Needless to say, she is not cooperating. With all the money she's gotten from South Korea, all the bodyguards, all the support, she refuses to cooperate. Now, why would that be? I should also note that she has never shown any knowledge or understanding of North Korean intelligence practices. One of the things that defectors do. On my Patreon site, I have a paper on North Korean defectors. They're mostly storytellers. Not entirely, but mostly. They get paid for their testimony, by the way. Often quite a bit. The higher ranking you are, the more important your testimony, the more you get paid. That means these people have an incentive to make themselves as powerful as they can. No one believes what North Korea says. There's no way to verify it. So it's a perfect scam. But anyone who's spoken to her, including intelligence people who were the ones to investigate her, there were just questions. There really was no investigation, but she had much contact with South Korean intelligence. She showed no understanding. She has never given South Korea any information on North Korean practices. You would think that she'd be the number one advisor on this stuff, but no one takes her seriously. The only thing, she rarely gives interviews, and the reason for that is so she doesn't contradict herself. The problem with other South Korean defectors, you know, South Korean defectors, almost every last one is attractive. There's not an ugly one. Do only hot people leave North Korea successfully? No, of course they're for TV cameras. The women are very, very, they're delicate little things, you know, like porcelain dolls. They're made up, they're dressed up. It's obviously a scam. Other maybe legitimate ones, but not the ones that you see on TV. And this woman is no different. She's not good looking anymore. I never had a thing for Asian women, but I think, you know, back then she was all right. But in North Korea, apparently, she was the biggest thing around. She actually was a minor celebrity there for a while. Again, being an actress. And somehow that qualified her to, get into the intelligence academy and then, of course, immediately be sent at Kim Jong-il. Anyway, she does not serve in that capacity whatsoever. There was one point, I think she was still in the UAE, she tried to grab a policeman's gun to escape and failed. It was clumsy. It was stupid. Clearly, she has no training whatsoever. She has not shown the slightest in her affect, in her presence, in her speech. She shows no understanding of this. She is not a military woman. She does not sound like one. She doesn't act like one. She is an actress. She wears a wig. She wasn't trained by anybody. Even in her book, she just uses very vague generalities that you can get from any movie. It's awful. You would think that she would be going on and on and on about how strict it was and what they do, kind of propaganda, what it was about. And she gets very maudlin about it. She says that when she was going to take her cyanide pill, what would the dear leader Kim Il-sung or Kim Jong-il want me to do? You know, that's the deity. And she has one line in there that made me laugh. She's talking about her, I got to imagine. There's so much here. When she was being recruited into the North Korean secret police for some reason, she was a 14-year-old girl, at least, and she's brought into the, she's taken down the principal's office of her school, and they begin asking her questions. And one of the things that this man who comes out of nowhere asks her is what, how would you summarize the creed of our Workers' Party? And this is in her book. She says, these four pillars, deification, creed, absolutism, and unlimited acceptance. And the guy says, oh, yes, you speak correctly. Now, there is no way, I mean, I don't even know how she thought that would be accepted by anybody. I don't even know what she's talking about here. Deification? I guess she means deification, the cult of personality. Nowhere is there, you know, pillars or anything like that. She just invented it. And she wrote it, and one of the reasons I think it came out in English is that she wrote it for a non-Korean audience. She wrote it for an audience that, thanks to Johnson's Law, would have no idea if she's telling the truth or not. Then, When she's questioned about certain specifics, suddenly she has no memory because she was brainwashed and she's traumatized. You know, it's one thing to... Anyway, there's been some very strange things said about her. When she gets interviewed, she was interviewed by... review shows up in Publishers Weekly. And it was a review of the book Shoot the Women First by Eileen McDonald. And again, there's not much... You know, it's about violent females. And because she won't say anything... There's not much in there. But she describes Kim as completely robot-like. Excuse me. She says, wholly submissive to male authority, she writes. In other words, you know, she's an empty shell. She does what she's told. There's something very wrong here. This is the event, by the way, that had the United States put North Korea on the index of nations that promote terrorism. This became a rallying cry for the Americans against North Korea, and in fact started the present onslaught against North Korea. Up until that point, as I've mentioned many times before, the U.S. was ambivalent. When South Korea was under a national socialist, and explicitly, and as dictatorship, though a very popular one, the U.S. had actually sided with the North, and I've proven that many times. When tunnels were found under the DMZ, the Carter administration said, it's not a problem. The North Koreans are fine. They're not going to do anything. Even after he found out that Kim Il-sung had gone to Brezhnev asking for permission to invade because the U.S. was involved in Vietnam, not a problem. So General Park eventually said, well, that's fine. You can go. We have our own nuclear arsenal that we're going to build anyway. Then all of a sudden the U.S. That's the only reason the Americans are staying there. And according to Jimmy Carter, because they don't want South Korea to have their own nuclear arsenal. Maybe this shouldn't surprise any of you, but she became a born-again Christian. In her book, she doesn't explain why that happened. Protestant evangelicals, especially in Russia, are, and in Turkey, we know this for a fact, are CIA conduits. The so-called pastor who's in jail in Turkey is so blatantly CIA, he might as well have it as a bumper sticker. And Putin has said this, and he's in a position to know, that so many of these groups have been kicked out of the country because they are CIA. Again, another piece of evidence that Kim is more a CIA asset than a K-CIA asset, the Korean Central Intelligence Agency. I'm not so sure that South Korea... South Korea had a lot to gain, and the only reason that South Korea is... the lawyers group is claiming that this is definitely South Korea. You have probably majority of the population that do. When she appeared on NBC in 2018... Look at the comments on YouTube. Almost everyone says this woman is an obvious phony. Speaking in Korean, and her speech is very robot-like. Everyone who's spoken to her, she doesn't have many guests, but they say that she has no emotion. There is no remorse. There's no nothing. There's nothing here. There's something very wrong here. At the time in South Korea, there was a faction fight after the fall of, the CIA killed General Park. They were slowly taking control of South Korean politics. There's a lot of money there. Bringing the bank back under Rothschild control, which had been taken away by General Park. If you haven't listened to my, South Korean, podcast, I did it last year, I think, early last year, please listen to it. Chun Doo-hwan wasn't around very long. It was an extremely unstable time in South Korea. Blowing up an airliner is not out of the realm of possibility. I refuse to believe that it happened without CIA assistance. Kim Jong-wei was, every once in a while gets trotted out and she says the most militant things. We have to destroy North Korea. Everything she said, by the way, when Kim Jong-un came to power, she said on Australian TV that well, he's not going to last long because he's too inexperienced. Every once in a while, you know, every time she says something of substance, it's usually wrong. She has no understanding of any of these things. She's an actress. But 115 Koreans were murdered that day. The Korean Peninsula changed forever. And a mass murderer was pardoned because, again, I think because she was an attractive woman has a lot to do with it. But also, because allegedly she was, obviously the government knew she didn't do it, even though she confessed. She has now, then she went on a rampage, claiming that the lawyers group, they're North Korean agents. That's how she responds to the families that have now gone after her, families of the victims. So apparently she's very remorseful. They're now suing her in court for libel, for saying something like that. Because she said it in writing as well as in speech. And again, she's refusing to cooperate with any of the authorities in this respect, and I think has fled the country. So that wasn't long enough really for a full show, but it's just one more thing. This bizarre that no one ever talks about. It's now reopened in Korea. It's still going on. To what extent did the CIA blow up the Korean airliner to change the politics of Korea, which we're still dealing with today, and to permit a democratically elected government that was pro-American to remain in Seoul, which of course it absolutely did. And this woman now somehow is a millionaire, who's still living somewhere in luxury, and no one says a word. Again, a lot because she's a woman, but also because she is intelligent. She's somebody's agent. Anyway, so we finished up the Russo-Japanese War. We dealt with the Korean airliner taken down by Kim Kwang-wae in 1987. And I don't mean to leave you depressed, but unfortunately that's the world we live in. Next time, I think we're going to continue on airline disasters promoted by intelligence. I'm going to talk about Aero Air. Flight 1285, which essentially was a USS Liberty in the air. The only difference is, of course, there weren't uniformed IDF doing this like it was in, you know, marked jets in the USS Liberty. But it's very similar with even worse results. Only Jim Fetzer has written a paper on this, which I'll use. And that will be the topic for the, unless something radical happens between now and then, Aero Air, the other USS Liberty, will be the topic for next week. So please tune in, and thank you everyone for listening as always. I'll talk to you next time. Bye bye.